Okay, this is the podcast for Tadeusz Borowski and his poem, This Way for the Gas, Ladies and Gentlemen, or Ladies and Gentlemen, This Way for the Gas, depending upon the translation. As you can tell from his biographical information, he's Polish, right? Gets swept up in the Holocaust, right? When the Nazis invade Poland, he gets his degree at an underground school and works for the resistance, basically, while he's writing poetry, works in a warehouse, it says, as a night watchman. His time in the camps convinces him that he's not going to write poetry anymore, he's only going to write prose. And so this collection of short stories, that the title of this story is actually the title of the entire volume, of stories about his time in the camps. And you see that he was in Pawiak and then Auschwitz, and then he catches pneumonia and is forced to work as kind of a nurse's aide or a doctor's assistant in a Nazi medical experiment hospital. And you know, the if you know anything about those kind of terrible experiments about, you know, speed operations, operations without anesthetic, removal of limbs, forced transplantation and implantations. It's really kind of terrible, tragic stuff. He ends up eventually at Dachau and is there when they're liberated, when the camp is liberated in 1945. And if you look at the dates there, you see that, you know, here's when we talk about, you know, kind of liberating the camps, we think, oh, wow, everybody got to go home. But no, they didn't, right? Where do you think they spent the night of May 1st, 1945? Back into the camps, right? There was no way that the Allied forces were prepared in any way to handle this amount of concentration camp people. He ends up spending 13 months before he's able to get back home in Poland. He finds out that his fiance actually survived the camps as well, but you know, she ends up in Sweden, right? And as it says, he turned to prose after the war, and turns to, as kind of most Europeans did, this kind of recognition there. In the West, we get a really kind of skewed view of just what happened in World War II, right? If you're not from the U.S., your recognition is that the fundamental people who suffered the greatest losses and contributed the most into destroying the Axis powers was not the Americans, not even the British, or certainly not the French, but it was the Russians. And so he joins the Polish Workers' Party because he sees communism as the only force that's able to address, kind of at a political level, fascism, because he knows that capitalism won't do that. He writes these political tracts, and for a while this is pretty good. However, in 1950, after he's done this for a few years, one of his best friends is taken away to not a concentration camp, but is imprisoned and tortured by the communists. And after kind of investing his whole life in this communist ideal, this manifestation of it as it was in Poland, he is so disheartened that by July, ironically, July of 1951, he's committing suicide. He's 28 years old. He commits suicide by... The irony is that he sticks his head literally in an oven to do that. The other background information you need kind of for this short story is on that Holocaust page that you have a link to. If you take a look at it, we know about the Jews, right? And you'll notice in the list there, there is no high or low estimate for the Jews. It's roughly 5.9 million Jews that were victims of the Holocaust. But all these other groups, right? Look, the next largest group, Soviet prisoners of war, they're supposed to be in POW camps. But instead, they were taken to concentration camps, and somewhere between 2 and 3 million of them died. If you were just Polish, somewhere between 1.8 and 2 million died. the Roma, and those that number is, has the wildest swing there between the low and the high estimates, because the Roma are essentially the unhomed, right? They're itinerants. They're what they're known as the tinkers or gypsies sometime, but we know they're kind of Eastern European. If you're disabled, there's no room for you in the Third Reich if you're disabled. If you're gay, but no, only if you're a gay man, right, were you taken there. Gay women, the Nazi High Command kind of liked gay women, right? This idea, this invisible sin, as they called it. And Jehovah's Witnesses, which is a really interesting idea in terms of religion, because Jehovah's Witnesses are an apocalyptic group, right? The world is coming to an end soon. You know, Hitler thought he was building a Reich regime, an empire that was going to last 1,000 years. There's no room there for people who think the world's going to end any day now, any second now. So instead of just 6 million Jews, we have the high end. We have over 12 million people who were victims of the Holocaust. And if you look at the next map of the concentration camps, you see the concentration camps are marked with a swastika and the death camps are marked with a skull and crossbones. And the interesting thing is, the reason why I put this here is, look where those death camps are. There are none of them in Germany. And that's for a couple reasons. The first is, purely economic, right? If you look at that list of people, right, Poles, Russians, Jews, where do they all live? They're all not living in Germany or even in the Czech Republic. They're all in Poland, the Ukraine, Lithuania, Belarus. Why bring those people? Why transport them all the way to Germany just to kill them? Essentially build the camps where they are. So the first is economic. The second is more of a political idea, right? When accused of having death camps or concentration camps, what the Germans could say is there are no death camps in Germany, and they would technically be correct, right? Because look at the list, there aren't any, right? The true death camps are scattered throughout Poland. And well, they you know, the New York Times has recently uncovered almost 1,000 other sub-camps, documentation for that haven't quite made, they haven't quite mapped them all out, but they've got the physical documentation. And the rest of these are pictures of things that might be appropriate to think of when you're thinking about, when you're reading through your Borowski text. There's a typical train unloading at a concentration camp. You'll notice the felt badges. Most of the badges were done as triangles, and with the Jews, they just took one triangle and laid it over to another to make this Star of David here. But there was a green triangle, a yellow triangle, a red triangle. And here's the second one is another train unloading, and you can see that chimney in the background is an actual crematorium. The guys in the striped suits, those are the people like the main character we're going to read about here. This is Canada, basically, as he talks about it, right? And there's a selection process where that woman with an infant child goes to join those being sent to the crematoria, right? That was like one of the fundamental rules of the Nazis, right? And we see this in the story. We see this mother denying her child because she wants to live. And this is kind of tragic, right? We see the end results of this are just horrifying. And some of the pictures later on are, you know, they're not the most graphic pictures of the Holocaust, but there are a few here, right? There's a crematorium oven with bones at Bergen-Belsen. Mauthausen, that's a typical forced labor camp there. Wasn't a death camp. These guys would be sent with literally little picks or hammers and told, your day's work is done when you give us 15 tons of gravel. Or some kind of ridiculous number like that. They chip away at this face and then break this all down. Here's another single-sex camp, Ravensbrück, with women. It looks like they're collecting firewood or brushwood, loading them on rail cars, their own internal railroad. And then we get some mass graves, this iconic photograph that was, in fact, in Life magazine of an SS guard hauling bodies into mass grave at Bergen-Belsen. The Nordhausen camp, and the rows of bodies there, and that's this picture here of General Eisenhower at the liberation of Buchenwald. In his memoirs, what he says is this was the most horrifying and emotional day of the war. I mean, he was the supreme commander of all Allied forces. And he says this recognition of this kind of inhumanity of the Germans was just overwhelming to him. Right? He walked into a private office and cried after this. And here we've seen those, you know, you've all seen terrible pictures of those camp survivors. This one isn't that bad, but here are camp survivors at the liberation of Ebensee. I don't know how long Ebensee they had to stay in the camp after it was liberated, but it was at least for a few more months after that. At least they kind of got some food and things like that. Now for Borowski's story, right, we see this kind of, these instances of kind of the power plays that are involved there, right? How the Germans use the prisoners to divide and conquer the other prisoners. Now, we could talk about how this is kind of an existential text because it looks absurd and it seems meaningless. But in actuality, the reason why I include this here as a form of existentialism is because there's only one choice, and it is a radical choice. When those people are taken off the transport cars, right, and we see them, right, this kind of unusual day when they're getting two cars in, right, when those people are taken off the cars, we see one woman make the choice to voluntarily walk to the line headed to the crematorium. She chooses death. Why would she do that? I think let's put the choice as baldly as we can. Are you going to spend the rest of your life working for something you know is absolute evil and helping it, right? The work you do helps it get stronger, helps it to achieve its goal of world domination? Or are you going to say, no, I will not spend my life that way, and therefore I choose death? Now, it's an interesting question. When I ask this in classes and we have a discussion about this, most people say, well, I would stay alive, right? Because there's always hope when you stay alive. Well, hope's a funny thing, and I get that, right? But what are you willing to give in order to keep your hope alive? Are you willing to work for absolute evil because your life is worth it? Well, that's a tough call. I mean, when you think about what day-to-day life would be like in one of the camps, I mean, it would certainly be kind of shocking, right? We know that the human body needs roughly 2,000 calories daily to maintain its body weight. What you were going to get from the Nazis was somewhere between 800 and 1,000 calories a day, right? Bread that was half flour and half sawdust, stuffed with mold, maybe potato skin soup, right? I mean, it's really pretty poor. But what are the Nazis doing out there? And we see this with the prisoners coming from Canada. What are they going to do? They get to take stuff from the prisoners coming in. Food, clothing, sometimes shoes. Now, they're not going to get to take anything that's really valuable. But the Germans are certainly going to look the other way, right, as they smuggle other stuff into the camp. Why? Because they know that anything that gets smuggled into the camp isn't a luxury, it's a necessity for life. So let's just imagine that you're in the shoes of somebody from Canada, right? Somebody who's working on that sorting dock. There's no, well, let's say you're able to walk in there with, I don't know, 5 pounds of sausages every day. You can't eat 5 pounds of sausage. You and your friends can't eat 5 pounds of sausage. So you start to distribute it around, and lots of people do this. Is it a trade? Is it a barter? Do you just give it? Well, and here, I really hate to say this, but here's this kind of demonic genius of the Nazis, is that no matter how much food you bring in, you're never going to have enough for anybody. How do you make the decision about who gets it? How do you make the decision? So somebody's kind to me, I give them food. Somebody does something else for me, I give them food. Well, eventually those people are going to get resentful, because even when they do things for me, some days I may not be able to give them food. There may not be something that comes in. I may get stopped at the gate and get some of my, you know, the guards might confiscate something. Eventually, right, the resentment among the prisoners builds. And that resentment builds not against the Nazis, but against fellow prisoners, the people who are bringing this in. It's the ultimate kind of divide and conquer move there. I also think we need to look at how, right, our narrator, this is his first day on the job, right? So these other people are kind of used to it. How do they deal with this? How do they answer these questions, right? They don't answer questions. They don't lie, but they don't tell the truth, right? They think about it as kind of a kindness, is to not tell these arriving people the truth. That, you know, your life is going to be spent, if you are selected to go to the camp, your life is going to be spent aiding and abetting this ultimate evil. But, right, how often or how well can you lie to yourself about these people, knowing what you're sorting these people to do? Right, we saw that instance of the infant and the mother. We saw, you know, we see the narrator who doesn't know what to do with the dead bodies coming out, right, holding those things, as he says, like chickens, I think he says. Some translations, it's turkeys, right? And the other woman takes it from him because he's just so absolutely kind of terrified at this. Look how they describe each other, especially these people coming off the trains. It's in animalistic terms. They dehumanize these people, as the Nazis themselves do. Right? It's the only way you can survive what you're doing, right? Is you can't think of these people as human beings. If you do, you're eventually going to snap. And we see our narrator, who's not used to this, we see him snap, right? While everybody else sits around, he goes and vomits. But the only solace they have is in drinking. Right? When they spend this whole day doing this, when they spend this kind of tragic day doing this, when that second car comes in, they don't treat them quite so kindly. The Germans don't even, you know, they're not helping people down off the train. They're not asking them nicely how to get out of the boxcars. They just spray it with bullets, and that makes everybody jump out. Why? Because even the Germans have to, I mean, they're humans too. Right, they have some kind of self-awareness and some recognition that they've been lying to themselves about this as they go along with this as well. Right? And here's kind of the inevitability of the absurdity is that tomorrow they're going to wake up and do that exact same thing again. Right, they're going to dehumanize other people. Is it enough? Right, is your life worth that much to do that? Right. So here's the fundamental question we're back to again. If you take the walk to the camp, you're willing to do anything. You're willing to treat fellow human beings in any way, because what you end up fundamentally saying is, my life is worth more than yours, right? My life is worth more than the way I treat you. Or do you say, I refuse to treat other people that way, and therefore I'm voluntarily choosing this death that will come perhaps inevitably anyway. Right? It's a horrifying, terrible, right? It's the Sophie's Choice question, isn't it? Right? If you haven't seen that movie, wow. It's a brilliant movie, but be prepared for the absolute depression. If you want another movie that's brilliant about this, there's the miniseries, the HBO miniseries, Band of Brothers. When they liberate the concentration camp, the kind of absolute horror that they see is just overwhelming. Absolutely, absolutely stunning in its kind of, in its impact, in its emotional impact on you, the viewer.